Elgin Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals. Hello and welcome to Elgin Talks, our investment commentary podcast. I'm Mark Chappell. Investment styles like growth and value go in and out of fashion, but since the financial crisis, growth investment has reigned supreme. The latest bouts of volatility, though, have prompted many to ask if the growth bull run is over. Joining us today to talk about this is two members of our active equity team, Gavin Launder and Matthew Courtnell, who have written a number of articles that argue that the age of growth is far from done. Matthew, Gavin, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Gavin, if I could start with you, is this really the case? Is the growth run dying of old age?
No, I don't think it is. I think what we've had in the last few months is a resetting of valuations between growth and value. But I would add that growth didn't get to the lofty valuations seen in the TMT bubble. They just got the gap between the two, value and growth, became a bit excessive, partly because value became even cheaper.
So that's the tech bubble of the early 2000s that we're talking about here.
Exactly.
Relative to the two of them, this does not look as high or overvalued.
Not as overvalued. And put in a broader context, you're still seeing good economic growth globally and within the UK. Well, define good, I suppose.
Yes.
Sub 2% in the UK, but not falling off a cliff.
Exactly. It's not minus. It's not something that investors should necessarily be too worried about.
Exactly. And globally, in excess of 3.5% per annum. So.
Matthew, what would you add here from if growth isn't quite so overvalued, what's driving people's fears about this?
Yeah, I mean, quite simply put, contrary to popular belief, the sky is not falling right now. End of cycle fears continue to escalate as sentiment has changed. But I think it's wrong to make the assumptions and apply a broad brush view that the cycle is over. High volatility, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But we do not believe we're now facing a bear market. And having listened to a previous podcast with Justin Onakuzi, I agree with his thinking that this is very much a late cycle, but not end of cycle.
Okay, so I think that's really the heart of this, is that people have seen that in 2018, over the last 12 months, there's been a lot more comparatively of volatility. And I guess that's had a lot of people kind of a little bit spooked, but really the fundamentals haven't changed. Would you agree with that?
I'd agree with that. The corporate fundamentals are still strong. Mm-hmm. What's changed is interest rates have started to move up a little bit in the US, and we've had a bit more volatility. And that has changed the way people value that growth short term. And that's effectively the rebasing we've had.
Talk to us a little bit more about where company valuations are now in the grand scheme of things.
Okay, well, we've just had one of the fastest resetting of valuations seen in the last 10 years or so. Some of these valuations are still premium to the market, significant premium, north of 25 times earnings. But that's only a worry if you think the earnings growth stops in the near term. If we can get comfortable, as we try to do, that earnings growth can continue for a more sustained period of 5 years plus, those valuations start to look a lot more reasonable.
Yeah, I suppose I'll just add there that UK equities are priced for a further sharp deterioration in global growth momentum. Mm-hmm. I mean, more broadly, looking across pan-Europe, cyclicals in particular have underperformed defensives these past few months, leaving them well below the implied level of global PMIs.
PMIs?
Purchasing manufacturing index.
Okay, so that's an indication of future growth in that sense. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, that's correct, yeah. I think it's various talks with Gavin over the past few weeks, we agree the recent dislocation in valuation multiples has created an environment of mispriced growth opportunities at all ends of the market cap spectrum.
So we're talking about even giant companies having their growth, their future growth, underestimated by the market.
Yes, I mean, the giant companies typically have slightly slower growth anyway, just by dint of their size, really. But yes, the mid-cap world, some names have become very, very popular growth stocks and probably had been overdone and overcooked, as it were. This recent volatility has taken the heat out of that a bit and made some of them quite attractive.
So it's not only is what I'm hearing you're saying is not only are you looking for these quality companies, but you're looking for them at a good price. I mean, it's not just buying anything that looks good in the near term.
Absolutely. We are looking for the quality growth, and if we can get it now at much cheaper than we would have done 2 months ago, that is interesting. And the quality is really defined as the ability to generate the cash to invest in the business, to generate high returns on the capital employed.
I think one thing as well to touch on there is that we've talked about this many times this year about the all-round scarcity of growth companies in the market. And that's not just the UK, there are other markets regionally which are seeing that. But for us, there are a select group of companies which are delivering sustainable growth, which, as Gavin mentioned, also comes with that quality premium attached to it.
So if we're looking for these truly quality growth names, what are, and you've mentioned a couple of the indicators of what makes a quality growth name, how can you determine what you would have the most conviction in investing in?
We screen for ideas using third-party screening tools to look for growth and versus valuation and so on. Once we've identified the companies that look attractive, we dig into their business models and how sustainable they may be, and then subsequently also meet the management quite often on a regular basis to dig into the longer-term prospects for the business, really.
So it's about meeting the company owners, company managers, and saying what's your plan to deliver growth, not just, you know, next year hitting your quarterly reporting targets. It's over the next 3, 5, 7 years. Or what kind of timescale would you be looking at?
As long as possible.
Okay.
Really. I mean, and if it was about the next quarter or something, we can always just talk to the analysts about that. Mm. We don't need to talk to the management and waste their time on that. We'll concentrate on strategy and longer term thinking with them.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, for us, it's about, you know, we're running high conviction portfolios on the active equity team. So with that in mind, we need to have best quality ideas on the portfolio from a growth perspective. I'd just like to go back a step, actually. And one of the key mantras, I suppose, for a growth investor within our team is how we view a stock eat stock world, if you will. And what I mean by that is, you know, we live in a very ruthless world with plenty of competition, where there are new routes to market opening up seemingly every day, and that's what that's doing effectively is lowering barriers to entries. You know, we can now start businesses from our bedroom, for example, but if we have access to a good router and a computer. So by adopting a best-in-class mindset and running a high conviction strategy, you know, we want to ensure we have the strongest conviction in ideas which will create value opportunities for our clients longer term.
It's quite a nice pithy way of thinking about a stock eat stock world. It's very much encapsulates the disruption that we see in the market. I mean, I imagine you both have seen that many times over in more recent years, and more so coming in the near future as well.
Yes, I mean, a lot of the companies we invest in are or were the disruptors of their industry. And one of the things we do focus on when we talk to them is how keen an eye they have on the risk themselves being disrupted by future developments by either technology or another company. So some sort of disruption is kind of at the root of most of these ideas.
Interesting. So it's very much not only identifying who's really changing things, but also making sure that they've got that one eye on the back back mirror to say who's coming up behind me and is coming gunning for my position.
Yeah, I mean, it's about long-term survival at the end of the day. And you don't have to be a private equity startup to have a niche product or an opportunity in the market. You can be an industry incumbent, but it just all depends around strategy allocation and what these businesses are looking to do from a long-term growth perspective.
It sounds like that must be quite a difficult conversation to be having with management to say, you know, we like what you're doing, but, you know, what's next? What's next? It's kind of, is that difficult in any way?
Not really. It only becomes difficult when the company stick their head in the sand and say, no, they've got the best product. And you know, most of them don't do that, to be honest.
Well, thank you for that.
But they do. I mean, certainly the companies we're interested in, the ones that, as I said, keep saying, that generate the cash to invest, they are spending a lot on R&D and new technology. They know they have to keep their good products being the best products and still look for new areas. So it's normally quite an exciting topic to talk about with them.
I mean, you allude to it there as well about conversations with management, and that is so important to us as active equity stock pickers, effectively. Seeing management twice per annum on a one-to-one basis is a minimum requisite for us. Yeah. And what that brings to the table is obviously that trust And it's the greater insight into how the business is being run on a day-to-day basis.
I imagine it's quite reassuring for them as well, if with your long-term mindset, as you were saying, that you're not, that you could, if you wanted next quarter's reports, then you'll just go to the analyst. You're meeting them about the future of their business, and they get that, you know, sense that, yes, it is a stock-eat-stock world, but you're with them, you're invested in them for the long term, for as long as they maintain a quality company.
Absolutely. I mean, we are very much looking for to have a portfolio of things that we don't have to keep trading, the things that we can own for a long time.
Exactly. And I imagine that keeps turnover costs down as well, which is
absolutely
very helpful.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to come back to that, this disruption element, it's how can you find these companies that maintain this element of a competitive advantage? What makes a winner in this space?
I think there's a combination of a number of different bits. I mean, obviously the growth itself, innovation and cash generation. And ultimately, when the growth starts to slow, they're still in a strong position. The cash generation starts to be returned to the shareholders as well as invested in the business. So they get to a sort of a significant size.
Okay.
So both sides then win.
Yeah, I mean, the importance of competitive advantage can't be underestimated here. And by that, I mean, I'm talking in regards to product strength, pricing power, and within their respective end market, their position. So ideally, we'd be looking for global leaders, or at least those which are going to soon challenge the top de facto player in the market.
I'd like to unpack one of those, perhaps, just to pick one of those. Pricing power. Could you talk to us a little bit more? Who would you say has pricing power? What does that mean to an investor like yourself?
Well, I mean, one of the more extreme ones with pricing power would be Aston Martin.
Really?
I guess. So you have the normal Aston Martins. There's nothing normal about any of them, but there's the Vantage and the DB11 production cars. But then on top of that, you have the specials. And the specials sell out very, very quickly. The management team have told us they often know the individuals almost to a man who is buying these things. And the pricing is extraordinary. So there's a new product called the Valkyrie. Mm-hmm. We're going to make 59 of them, going to price it £1 million each because they thought that's what they needed to do. They ended up making 100 of them, priced at £2 million each. They got orders for 600, so they priced them at £2.5 million each.
Wow.
Now, that is pricing power.
That's
not every company will have quite that pricing power.
No, but it's a wonderfully vivid example of the clear demand for your product and being able to command such a response.
But it also emphasises this is a luxury goods company, not just a auto manufacturer.
No, of course. I mean, this is not about to revive the grand automobile sector, but it's so interesting to see this luxury goods having such value, both as a brand, I'm sure, and I'm sure Aston Martin's management team talked to you a great deal about how they maintain their brand into the future.
Yeah, the brand is key to them and they know it. They actually have two brands. They have Aston Martin, they have Lagonda, which they're going to use or revive as an electric vehicle range in a few years' time. But they do invest a lot in the brand, largely through Formula One, where it's the Aston Martin Red Bull team, occasionally through licensing arrangements. There's an Aston Martin boat out there, for instance. But they wouldn't do anything to endanger the brand name.
No, I'm sure not. That seems very dangerous.
Yes.
We'd be playing with fire, I'd imagine.
Exactly.
Yes, yes. Well, Aston Martin, another good example of a company which is built on their scale. They have brand establishment. And obviously innovation, which Gavin alluded to there, and some of their specials models really highlights that point and what they can effectively charge and what people are actually willing to pay does highlight that point.
We've talked about how they can be positioned for the future. And I'd quite like to talk about, you alluded to electric vehicles there as an example of this kind of big technology that we know is coming down the line. And in 5, 10, 15 years, it's only going to grow. What are the other kind of more secular themes, if I can put it that way, that you are seeing coming down the line into the future where this is what's throwing up your stock ideas or your stock investments?
The demographic trends of that affect different markets in different ways. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, we've alighted on the Middle East, which has a surprisingly young demographic, but an incredibly poor lifestyle. So it's a health care issue. And it got to such an extreme that the local government or the governments in the region started mandating for healthcare. so that companies had to provide healthcare for people. That meant they started using doctors and going to hospitals and so on. So that has been a strong growth business on this sort of demographic trend. Mm-hmm. Other ones we've been looking at would be e-commerce has been a big issue.
E-commerce is in the logistics around kind of online shopping, that sort of thing.
Both the logistics, the shopping itself, or the marketplaces. If it's a, you know, something like a Just Eat, where you go on and order your food or an
interesting. So it's kind of the delivery of these platforms, if you will, of the like Deliveroo, Just Eat, these kind of where existing restaurants can come on board and access a market that they might not previously have delivered to.
Exactly, and increase utilization of their kitchens. So in some models, they can turn that on and off. They can be on the site when they're not busy, off it when they are, and so on.
So it's really kind of it's not necessarily you're tied into or just this.
There
new
are different,
platform.
Slightly different models, but yes, exactly. You can be quite flexible.
E-commerce is one we've explored recently on the podcast through Ocado, who have really digitalized this kind of factory warehouse, bringing a lot of automation, robotics into there. The digitalization of economies seems to be growing at an ever faster pace. And Matthew, I know you've written very recently about Aveda. Oil and gas, I mean, is quite a very technical sector anyway. So how can you digitalize that? I mean, talk to me more about this asset optimization. How can we bring digital assets into this quite analog sector, as I would perhaps think of it?
Yeah, so sure. So, well, I guess the energy one's a good place, actually. So BP, for example, which is should be well known to many investors, one of the biggest players in the UK. They recently had an upstream oil and gas investor trip in Oman last week. Okay. And the biggest takeaway from that was how technology is really transforming the oil industry more rapidly than we'd expected. Now, what we mean by that is, and some good examples, I'm going to probably talk about things here, you're probably going to want me to further explain, but the digital twin is a phrase which has been coined for a good couple of years now. And what that effectively means is where we can create a digital replica of a physical asset, whether it's a object or a process. And what that effectively allows a business to do is change the supply value chain through a digital world and seeing obviously how it would impact it without actually making the physical cost burden of sending an engineer to improve a particular part of the plant or repair one part of the plant. Whereas with this digital software, it's much more cost effective for businesses and allows a greater optimization of the entire industry process, whether that be an oil and gas field to a warehouse, which obviously is filled to the bits with robotics and sensors and other autonomous devices. And having this digital representation really allows a much greater opportunity for businesses to review the portfolio and how they can actually optimize performance.
So the way I'm imagining this is, and absolutely correct me if I'm oversimplifying, but imagine a kind of oil rig where someone, rather than an engineer looking at a lot of valves down in the blasting engine room, is actually sitting in a control room seeing a hologram or maybe a screen
Star
representation.
Star Trek is perfectly fine to be represented here.
Exactly.
You can have big wall-to-wall screens and just visualize the whole plant.
So you can see everything that's going on within from the situation of the control room rather than going down, having to inspect individual pipes.
Yes.
I mean, and that's...
You don't even have to be on the oil rig, to be fair.
Wow. Yeah. See, and just that is a major change which people would not have expected to have happened so quickly.
I think that's fair. I mean, augmented reality was talked about in, you know, the science fiction realm was even as early as, you know, well, more recently as 5 years ago. And now we're actually seeing businesses like Aveda actually use that in real time, which is incredibly impressive.
To do a little bit of a 180 here, away from the oil and gas industry and the technology company of Aveda, I'd like to go back a little earlier when we were talking about Aston Martin. We talked about the power of brands, and the brand power of certain companies is so important to the future growth of that company. You've mentioned recently about purchasing Fevertree. Now, that's a really interesting company to look at that's really sprung up. What is it about Fevertree's brand that's so appeals recently?
It's almost a chicken and egg situation. So if we take the UK market to start with, because that's where Fevertree began, they have done very, very well on the back of this gin rebirth, if you like, and then a sort of massive expansion, number of distilleries and so on. Or has it been the other way around? They've benefited by people's use of Fevertree. So they've gone together and grown together quite dramatically with some very clever marketing, building up a brand of, you know, using the best ingredients. You're buying these expensive gins, so why would you use anything other than the best mixers, etc. To the point where in a very short period of time, they have 40% of the UK market.
That's it's an incredible growth. I mean, they were still a very young company, if I'm right in thinking.
Still, I forget how many employees. Under 50 employees still?
Something like that.
So, yes, still very small.
Very small, and yet high market share.
And now they're turning their attention to the rest of the world.
bringing tonic to the world.
Exactly. So, I mean, start with Europe. And in some markets, they're already well established. It's surprising to some, perhaps, that one of the biggest gin markets in the world is Spain. Hmm. And gin and tonic is a drink of very much in favour. So Fevertree addressed that market. Other markets are going to take a bit longer to develop. And now they're focusing on the US. Whilst they're not necessarily the biggest gin drinkers in the world, there's probably more gin drinkers than there are here just by dint of the size of the market.
Sheer population size,
exactly. So they've signed a very attractive distribution deal in the US, which should help them build that brand name.
Yeah, I think Fevertree is a great example of the deep dive fundamental analysis that active investors have to undertake before becoming comfortable with any growth or value stock in the market. Lots of people concerned that obviously Fevertree's phenomenal growth in the UK can't go on forever, which is what you would expect as they obviously get to a certain peak point within market share gains perspective. But then you have the next upside to the story, which comes from the US, and that's a fantastic opportunity. And having seen management very, very recently, you know, we can get comfortable with the growth rates that the company believe they can deliver. But based upon meeting them, sort of seeing their product in the market and actually having an understanding of how they actually can deliver upon that growth at a much longer term perspective.
To take this back around to perhaps the beginning of the conversation, where that really is an example of looking at a company's a longer term growth rate, where that's the short term view is exactly that, is that it's grown to 40% of the UK market. How much further can it go? Time to sell. When actually, if you do the deep dive and meet the company management and look at this on a fundamental basis, how are they allocating that capital to the next part of their growth story?
Absolutely. And this is, as you both alluded to, part of the work, part of the reason for meeting the management and getting comfortable with it, because the danger was with a value company or highly valued company such as Fevertree, the danger of a gap between one market going X growth and another one starting growth could be quite an expensive gap.
Yes, of course.
So first of all, we got comfortable with the fact that the UK market, whilst it's slowing down, wasn't slowing down too dramatically and not as fast as some of the analysts had thought. So it's still growing over 30% year on year. And then the deal they've signed in the US probably brings the US growth nearer to us. So the chances of a gap in that growth profile is much, much less now at a corporate level. Couple that with the resetting of valuations in the market in the last couple of months. Makes it look very, very attractive at these levels.
So that takes me on to our final area where I'd like to talk to you about what's really important for when you look at companies of their strategic allocation of their capital.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I mean, reinvestment rate and growth capex is by far the most important thing for a growth-focused
investor.
That's
capital expenditure.
Capital expenditure. So we're looking for businesses which are actually, rather than allocating money back to shareholders in the form of dividends, these are the businesses, from an allocation perspective, are prioritising growth investment. So that might well be increasing the level of R&D, so research and development. It might be looking at bolt-on acquisitions, or it might be just looking at organic footprint expansion in the form of new products and innovation, for example.
And there are several different business models, or many different business models within here. So some of them do require sort of a fair amount of capex, whether they're buying equipment and so on. And others, at the other end of the extreme, they're quite capex light. So you might have Ashtead buying lots of construction equipment to feed its business, which it rents out construction equipment, to Fevertree, where they're actually getting other people to produce their tonics and whatever in the US and in France. So they contract out the bottling. So right across that, but it's, despite the different models, it's being able to reinvest in new products, in new production facilities, and just to be able to continue growing the business.
If I've understood this correctly, then to take us back to right at the beginning of the podcast, in your view, the age of growth is not it's far from done, because despite the scarcity of quality companies, they are there, but you have to look for these fundamentals of where companies are really reinvesting and are positioned for the long-term structural trends. Would you say that's about correct?
That is about correct. I mean, there are features, as you say, reinvesting. If they have high returns and they're reinvesting, that just propels those things. So we prefer companies that don't keep coming back to us for asking more money, basically.
Yeah, I mean, we're living in a time where disruptive innovation is effectively pioneering thematic investing. So there's a massive focus on the pace of innovation, which we believe is unlikely to let up anytime soon. We're in a world where R&D is integral to the things we talked about earlier with regards to market positioning, competitive advantages, for example. So this all ties in. But just on your point, which I think I will highlight, which you mentioned about the growth scarcity, this is just one anecdotal example. But looking at IBIS estimates for next 12 months forward from now, for the FTSE All Share, we're looking at a sales growth rate for the FTSE All Share of just 3.9% and earnings growth of 7%.
That's, you know, not very dramatic or dynamic growth, but we can find companies growing top line at least double that. And with earnings growth of 2 to 3 times that. Now, you end up paying a little bit more than the market average PE. Mm-hmm. But combine that with the sort of quality returns profile you have, there are opportunities there for sure.
Yeah, I mean, quality growth does not come for free, just to reiterate that. And for us, we believe these names rightly command a premium, given their ability to deliver superior returns longer term.
Absolutely. A great way of summing up exactly why it's so important to look at the fundamentals of these growth companies for the long-term benefit of our investors. Matthew, Gavin, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you for listening. If you'd like to read more about Gavin and Matthew's thoughts, please visit our Future World blog. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you to our wonderful production team. Thank you and goodbye. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.